Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Roy Eisenhart. I'm a former chair of the book jury here and a loyal supporter of the Commonwealth Club. I want to acknowledge that this program is part of the club's Good Lit series sponsored by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's also being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Health and Medicine member-led forum. And now it's my honor to introduce to you our distinguished speaker and writer tonight, Abraham Verghese. Dr. Verghese was born in Ethiopia of Indian parents. He went to medical school in Madras, India, but did his residency in Tennessee and then his fellowship at Boston University in infectious disease. He returned to Tennessee and practiced there for quite a few years and then took a right angle turn in his life for a period of time when he went to Iowa and attended the writer's workshop and got his MFA. After that, he went to Texas and practicing medicine for quite a time, and that's where he wrote his nonfiction book that I also recommend to you, My Own Country. At present, Dr. Verghese is, of course, a member of the Stanford Medical School faculty and the assistant chair of the Department of Medicine at Stanford Hospital. So without further ado, I introduce to you Dr. Verghese.
Thank you very much, Roy, for that wonderful introduction. I've frequently heard Commonwealth Club lectures on the radio and often wondered what it would be like to be here in the audience. I didn't anticipate being the speaker, so it's a particular delight. And I want to thank Wendy and her wonderful crew for inviting me to be here. What I would like to do in the time I have is tell you a little bit about what brought me to medicine. And ironically, it involves a book. And I'd also like to tell you what then took me from medicine to wanting to write a book. And I hope to end by telling you a little bit about my beliefs in medicine and the sorts of things that I am espousing at Stanford. And then I would love to take your comments and questions, if that sounds like a good plan. Let me begin by telling you that as you heard from Roy, I was actually born in Africa. I was born in Ethiopia to Indian parents who were hired there as school teachers. And there's a bit of a story there that I think is relevant. I'm a great fan of the quotation that geography is destiny, or the saying, geography is destiny. And believe it or not, for many, many years, I labored under the false belief that this was something that Freud had said, because it had been taught to me that way in medical school by very distinguished professors, and I had no reason to doubt them. And they told me that Freud said geography is destiny, and they claimed that he said that in the context of the fact that we emerge from the birth canal in close proximity to the organs of excretion and so on. And this therefore explained everything. And I thought it was actually quite fascinating, and I was really pleased to carry around that fact and to say geography is destiny, and embarrassed in my 40s to discover that it was actually Napoleon who said that. And Napoleon said it in the context of France's position with the English Channel on one side and so on. But it's actually a very profound statement. It's somewhat self-evident, but it's actually quite profound. Geography is destiny. My parents come from a part of India, the southern part of India, Kerala, where there's a sizable Christian community. And they are called Syrian Christians because their belief is that St. Thomas the Apostle arrived from Antioch and converted natives to Christianity before St. Peter got to Rome. And so my name, Verghese, is really quite similar to George. George became Borghese in Italy and Borghese in Portugal and Verghese in India. Now, this is only important to know because when the emperor of Ethiopia was making a state visit to India, they took him to see the Taj Mahal and they took him to see all kinds of attractions, and he wanted to go see the churches of St. Thomas. He asked to go see that because he was from an old, ancient Christian kingdom surrounded by Muslim nations, and he was very aware of this Christian sect in India. And so he came to Kerala to see the churches of St. Thomas, and he happened to be on the roads driving just when thousands of school kids in uniform, their hair freshly washed and jasmine in their hair. This is the girls had the jasmine in the hair, walking to school. And he was so taken by the sight, by the orderliness of it, that he hired all 400 of his school teachers for the first wave of schools he was building from this one community. And so my mother and father were hired and arrived in Africa, not knowing each other, arrived within a week or two of each other. They both taught physics, and they are quite silent about how exactly they met. My brothers and I think it had something to do with physics or chemistry, perhaps. In any case, they met and married there, and I was born there. And geography is destiny. The fact that I was born there really changed my life quite a bit. And it was a notion that I wanted to play with in this book, Cutting for Stone, the whole idea of geography as a character and the idea of geography and shifting geography as being something that brings about change. I have an older brother who was a precocious math whiz. He was just quite amazing, and he's actually now a professor at MIT, has been for many, many years, the real brains in the family. And in middle-class Indian parents are very much like middle-class Jewish parents, in as much as a child you quickly learn that your choices are, growing up, that you can be a doctor, a lawyer, or a failure. These are your options. And in the mid-50s, that was expanded to include engineer. So it's doctor, lawyer, engineer, or failure. And so when my brother was just in short pants, and he must have been about 8 or 9, when he announced with quite a bit of ceremony, when he announced that he wanted to be an engineer, the joy that my parents expressed was something to behold. Nothing I had ever said had brought that kind of reaction from them. And I remember quite promptly announcing to them that I wanted to be a physician. And they were pleased enough with it. It seemed almost plausible because I had a great fascination with blood, mostly my own. I was always getting into scrapes. I was also, interested and fascinated by the animals being prepared for the kitchen next door. And I was, quite fascinated by animals giving birth and by animals engaging in a strange congress that I didn't realize had anything to do with their giving birth. I mean, but all that could now pass as a form of scholarship, if you will. And so when I announced that I was going into medicine, I think they sort of bought it. But my real calling to medicine really came a few years later, and it came from a book. And the book was Of Human Bondage. And I will tell you that I was a precocious reader. I was, I think I was 9 years old when I discovered Lady Chatterley's Lover. And I was 9 and a half when I picked up Lolita. And I picked up Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage because the title held great promise. And I found, to my great surprise, that the book was infinitely better than anything I could have ever imagined. How many of you have read Of Human Bondage out of curiosity? Well, that's wonderful. It is sort of a book that not as many people engage with as they should. But for those of you who haven't, it's an extraordinary book because it begins on the first page with a young boy, Philip, who's no more than 3 or 4 years old, being brought to his mother's deathbed to say goodbye to her. And this kid has a club foot. He's put on the bed. She says something like, "Be a good boy, listen to what people say." And then she dies, and the father's not in the picture, and he's brought up by these very strict foster parents. And, within 2 pages, you are completely, feeling terribly sorry for this child. And his childhood is hard. He has some very strict foster parents. He is bullied at school because of his club foot. And his only outlet is painting. He loves to paint. And so as soon as he finishes high school, he makes his brave escape. He leaves England and goes to Paris. That had always been his dream, to go to Paris. And he goes to Paris to become an artist. And he's extraordinarily happy. And he's pursuing his painting. And there's only one problem with this, and that is that he's very, very poor. He has very little money. He's starving. He doesn't even have winter clothes. He's, he's just struggling to make ends meet, and he's suffering a crisis of faith. Should he do this or not? And one day he happens to be standing in the street underneath his apartment building in the cold, shivering, and he's there because he doesn't have the rent and he's avoiding the landlady. And while he's standing there, he sees his landlord, he sees his art teacher go by, a gentleman by the name of Monsieur Foinet. He sees his famous art teacher who exhibits in the National Gallery walking by. And on an impulse, he stops him and he says, Monsieur Foinet, would you please come up and take a look at my paintings and tell me if I have what it takes to go on? I'm at my wit's end. And Monsieur Foinet normally wouldn't do such a thing. And against his better judgment, just taking pity on him, he agrees. And he goes upstairs and he looks at all the paintings in great detail. And he finally turns to him and says, effectively, he asks him how his resources are. Does he have money? And he says, no. I know, sheepishly, Philip says he's very poor. He doesn't really have much in the way of resources. And Monsieur Foinet says an interesting thing. He says, don't be shy about that. He says, money to an artist is like a sixth sense. And without it, the other five don't work very well. And, I know it sounds kind of funny, but I actually think it's quite serious. And whenever I'm asked for writing advice, which is rare, I will often say, get a good day job. And I'm not being facetious. I think there's nothing harder for an artist or a writer to have to feel that you have to pay the rent with your art. It's very, very hard. In any case, and then Monsieur Foinet essentially turns to Philip and says, is there something else you can be doing? And Philip is crestfallen. He's heartbroken. But he's also grateful. This is exactly what he wanted his teacher to tell him. And Monsieur Foinet hastens to tell him, don't take it badly. I wish someone had told me this when I was your age. There is nothing worse for the temper than discovering your mediocrity at an advanced age. That's the exact line. And so Philip, with his heart broken, nevertheless, goes back to London, reconciled to the fact that he can't make it as an artist, and happy to have discovered that without spending another 25 years pursuing that. And he enters the medical profession. He enters medical training because there's a small annuity left for him to do just that. And he struggles through the first 2 years of medical school. It's always hard. Arrives on the wards in his third year, and Somerset Maugham describes that moment when Philip encounters patients for the first time. And he says, Philip saw humanity there in the rough, the artist's canvas. And there was an extraordinary sense I had in reading that all of a sudden. I don't think that it necessarily speaks that way to any other reader, but it did to me. And that's the beautiful thing about books, is that they speak to us individually. What that line said to me, humanity there in the rough, the artist's canvas, what it said to me is that not everybody could be a brilliant mathematician or artist, but anybody with a genuine interest in the human condition, with a true empathy for their fellow human being and a curiosity, could with some hard work be an excellent physician. That's what I took away. And this was my grand epiphany. This was a big, big moment for me. And I remember the great irony, because I could not announce to my parents that I decided to go into medicine, because I already had. And I think I was also learning from books that such outward grand pronouncements meant very little, and what really mattered were these, quiet moments of inner conviction that a book brought about. And I will always be enormously grateful to that book. And I think I always had in the back of my mind this notion that books can call people to medicine. And in fact, many a physician in this audience will acknowledge that a book like Arrowsmith or a book like Microbe Hunting by Paul de Kruijf might be the book that brought them to medicine. And I entered medicine with a great passion. I saw medicine because of that book as being a romantic and passionate pursuit, which to this day it remains. I absolutely love medicine. And the notion to write came about in a funny sort of way. I was practicing in Tennessee. I had just finished my training in infectious diseases at Boston University, and I had just lived through an extraordinary time in medicine that many of you will remember, where in the about 1982, 83, we were seeing primarily young men coming in with bizarre infections, things like pneumocystis pneumonia and cryptococcal meningitis, all of which we'd seen before, but always in the context of immune suppression or transplant. But these young men were coming in with no explanation for what was causing this. And I think all of us had a very strong sense that we were dealing with a brand new disease. And it was scary. It was exciting. And I remember waking up one morning and seeing that the Boston Globe headline read that Gallo and Montagnier had discovered the cause for AIDS. And, I remember thinking, well, it can't be more than a few months from now we'll have a treatment for it. And instead of which we had a HIV ELISA test developed. And suddenly we realized that for every one person in the hospital, there might be 200 or so others out there carrying the virus. And everything we had learned suggested that they would also have the same inexorable downhill decline that we had seen in our hospitalized patients. But I was leaving Boston. I was going to Johnson City, Tennessee, population 50,000, a new medical school. And all the experts, all the pundits told me that I could expect to see one HIV-infected person every year or every other year, because AIDS was very much an urban disease. And certainly when I got there, I didn't see any HIV. But then I saw my first patient, and then within a few months, I saw my second patient. And then it became a monthly event, and then a weekly event, and then a twice-a-week event. And in a very short time, I thought, I was following almost 100 people with HIV in a town of 50,000, which was 100-fold more than the CDC or anyone else had predicted. And I remember feeling very, very beleaguered for many different reasons. One was I had a strong sense that I was dealing with two diseases, not one. On the one hand, there was the virus and everything that you and I know this virus can do. But on the other hand, there was this metaphor that traveled with the virus, and it was a metaphor of shame and secrecy. And the metaphor was so powerful that it had tainted anyone who came close. And I even felt that one patient had been killed by the metaphor, a patient who I did not describe in the book I eventually wrote. I had the misfortune to have to tell him that his HIV test was positive. And I, in those pre-Ryan White days, I sat with him for 1 hour and counseled him. I was very worried about how he was taking this. And I asked him to come back the next day so we could talk some more. And you must recall, this was the days we had nothing to offer in terms of reversing the virus. And instead of coming back the next day, that night, he engineered a shootout in a nightclub where he pulled a gun and the police were obliged to gun him down. And I always thought that he had been killed not by the virus, but by the metaphor, by what it meant to have HIV in that town. And there was a moment when it became quite clear to me what was going on in that town, why this town had 100-fold more infection than anyone had predicted. And it turned out that it was not because the town was a hotbed of sexual intrigue and duplicity, which it was, by the way, but that was not that was not the explanation. Instead, it appeared that I had stumbled onto a paradigm of migration, which goes something like this. A young man grows up in a small town and leaves for all the same reasons that you and I leave small towns: jobs, education, opportunities. But in their case, they were also leaving because they were gay and did not want to live that lifestyle under the close scrutiny of their friends and relatives. And so they made their silent escape, and they came to the big cities, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, and Florida, and so on, and found themselves. And, somewhere along the way, decades later sometimes, the virus found them. And they were now retreating to their rural homes for a variety of reasons, either because they were very ill and they had cared for their partners who had died and now they were sick and there was no one else to care for them, or they weren't ill. They were just retreating, hoping that by coming back to a simpler existence, they could miss this plague that had somehow affected everybody else. And I remember the moment that I saw this paradigm most clearly. By the deathbed of a patient who I called Hobart in the book, and Hobart exemplified the paradigm. He had grown up in that town, and his earliest memory, he has an older brother. His father was a preacher, his mother was a homemaker, and one of his earliest memories was walking through the schoolyard and his brother turning to him and saying, "Must you walk that way?" And he wasn't aware that the way he walked was in any way different than the way the rest of the world walked. And yet as he grew older, that was one of many differences that made him feel a complete alien in that town. And so as soon as he could, he made his brave escape. He came to San Francisco. He worked in a 5-star hotel. He wore a tuxedo every day and had a wonderful flat in the Castro with his own framed and signed Mapplethorpe prints. And, you know, he was a very, very happy individual. Somewhere along the way, the virus found him, and he actually presented to San Francisco General with severe chest pain. They thought of all the usual suspects, heart attack and pericarditis and this and that. But by the third day, he broke out into a rash, and it became clear that he had shingles, and his HIV test was positive. And he stayed in the hospital almost a month, and when he was done and they discharged him, his job was gone. He'd been evicted from his apartment, and all his belongings were in the basement of a friend's apartment, a friend who was also sick and in the hospital. And so he made the one call he must have dreaded to make to his parents to say, "I'm coming home." And there I was at the tail end of that migration. Well, I saw this paradigm most clearly at his deathbed. He had been dwindling for many, many months. I was taking care of him for a long time. And just before he died, I had hospitalized him, and I was unable to find the cause of this fever that was just raging in his body. And on one morning when I rounded at the hospital, he said to me, "Abraham, I don't want you to do anything more for me. I'm done. I just want you to let me go home." And I couldn't argue with him. I knew that there was not much I was offering. And I let him go home. And a few days before he died, he called me up and he said, "Abraham, when I die, I don't want an autopsy. But if you like, you can come to my house and do biopsies of some of my organs. And then you'll know what had been going on all this time." And I think he knew that I had had such a hard time getting pathologists to do autopsies. In fact, I had a hard time getting anyone to do anything. I was pulling teeth. I was doing, bone marrow biopsies. I was doing as many things as I could so that I didn't have to bother another specialist and have them say, "No, I can't do it." And so I promised him that I would. And I went to his deathbed after he died. And I remember standing there looking at his body, and he looked so Christ-like in his diaper, looking like a loincloth, and the rest of his body bare, and his hair long and wispy. And I remember being very struck, as I am today, by the sight of a body outside the hospital. It's quite dislocating. And then I remember looking up and seeing that I suddenly realized this was his childhood room. This was where he'd grown up. And these were the icons of his childhood, a framed needlepoint verse, framed in cedar, and a picture of Christ at Gethsemane. And yet I could suddenly see these were not his icons. His icons were in a friend's basement in San Francisco, a friend who might be dead by now. And I could suddenly see this migration, how this little boy had grown up with a great deal of love in that town. And yet, he must have felt like an alien. And he left. And he found his way, and he made his brave escape. But tragically, somewhere the virus found him, and here he was coming back. And even though he was received with such love by his wonderful parents, it must have seemed like a horrible failure for him to be dying in that room. And that night I went home, and I wrote a scientific paper describing this migration. It's become a widely cited paper, but even as I wrote it, I felt that the cold and unimaginative language of science didn't begin to capture the heartache of those families, didn't begin to capture my own grief at living through this again and again, didn't begin to capture the heroic and tragic nature of this voyage. And that is the moment I became a writer. I decided I would tell that story. And I'm hoping in the question and answer session you can ask me more about how exactly that came about. And I will tell you this, though, that I decided to write that story, and I thought it would be fiction. My first love has always been fiction. And I thought that that's how I'm going to tell the story. I love the quote by Dorothy Allison. She says, "Fiction is the great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives." And that's what a great novel does. And And so I wrote a short story called Lilacs, a very dark AIDS story. It was accepted by The New Yorker as I was leaving Iowa. I thought, well, this is my big break. And The New Yorker had a great deal of interest in that story. And they were interested in my submitting a proposal for a nonfiction piece about AIDS in rural America. And I was very excited because The New Yorker pays about $1 a word. And I thought 100,000 words would be just right for them, you know. And to make a long story short, they didn't buy the proposal for many reasons. One is that the editor I was working with was leaving. Tina Brown was coming on board, and she did other things with me, but not that piece she did not want. And that's how my first nonfiction book was sort of born. And then came another nonfiction book, and then the book that is out there today, Cutting for Stone, represents the book that I always wanted to write. I always wanted to write a book that would convey the great love affair I've had with medicine, convey the great romance and passion that one can have with medicine, convey its pitfalls, convey the dangers of a life in medicine. I think, Roy, with your advice, I might at this point try and conclude my prepared remarks and start to turn this over to you for questions. I'll just say one thing, if I may. I heard a speaker just 2 days ago at Stanford, a geneticist who deals with very, very rare disease. And his last slide, on his last slide, he had the words, "Thank you for your time," in quotation marks. And I thought this is a strange way to end a PowerPoint lecture. But what he said is, you know, I put that up there because when my patients come to me with this very rare condition that he specializes in, and they've come, you know, because he's the world's expert, and they arrive there, and it's a, you know, it's a condition, the diagnosis of which alters the life of not only the person who has it, but there are implications for the family, for the children, and so on. When patients leave him after he spends a good hour, hour and a half with them, with this team, which is what you have to do in that particular setting, they always end, they often leave saying, "Thank you for your time." And I think it's a wonderful way to remind our house staff especially that time is the most precious commodity we really have to offer our patients. And if there's one line that summarizes my belief in medicine, that would be it. Many, many obstacles why it doesn't always work. But so thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Verghese. For our radio audience, I want to remind you that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and tonight we're honored to have Dr. Abraham Verghese, who has been discussing many topics across both his writing career and his practice of medicine. The focus of our discussion tonight is around his recently released book in paperback, Cutting for Stone, which is a highly motivational novel that, as Dr. Verghese said, makes you understand why people are drawn to the practice of medicine and fulfilled by it. You invited us during your talk to ask you more about how you got into writing. So before I actually get into the audience questions, I'm going to take you up on your cue, if you okay. would cover that.
I think the seminal moment for me came in Tennessee when the hospital administrator called me into his office, and this was in the fifth year of this growing HIV practice, and I was feeling very beleaguered, and he said to me, "Abraham, sit down," and then he says, "Do you think we'll have more HIV in the years to come?" This is in 1989 or so, and I'm thinking, well, what planet is this guy from? I mean, you know. I said, "Yes, I think we will." And then he said, "But if you were not here, would this hospital see as much HIV?" And he actually had a point because I was willing, patients were coming from some distance. And, you know, people were coming from Knoxville a good hour and a half away and coming even from Nashville because anonymity was hard to find when you were going to go look to your own town, to your own town doctor. So there was some truth to what he said. But when he said that, I suddenly felt that my connection with the town was broken and that I could do what I was doing anywhere. It didn't have to be there. And I, you know, I had felt this tremendous obligation to just stay there and do this. And at that moment, I realized that I can do this anywhere. And if I'm going to do it for a lifetime, and I'm proud to say that I'm still doing that, then it is important to take breaks. And I decided I would take a break and I would write. And I decided to apply to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And the only criteria for admission then and now, I think, is two stories. Nothing else matters, not your degrees or letters or nothing like that. And so I told myself, I'll submit the two stories. If they take me, I will go. And they did, and I went. And so on New Year's Eve 1989, I dragged my wife and two young children across, to Iowa, driving. And it was, if that doesn't make you take yourself seriously as a writer, nothing else will. And I should say that I think people have all sorts of illusions about what Iowa is like. And to me, it was just wonderful, but not for the reasons you would imagine. So the workshop then, and I think it's still true, meets once a week. And you discuss two stories put up by the students. And when your story is up, you sit there like a fly on the wall and you don't respond. And you have the wonderful opportunity to hear people who care deeply about writing, including a visiting writer who's been there for the semester, respond to your story. And, the entire time I was there, I never heard anyone use the word agent or, story point or any of the things that you read in the how-to write books. It was all about the word on the page, and the greatest respect for that, and about finding that moment when this whole thing that you had put up clunked because you had done something clumsily. And they were going to point that out to you. And so I found that the kind of writing that your wife thinks is cute and your mother thinks is precious doesn't fly. In fact, when your spouse becomes deeply disturbed by something you're doing and you're writing, then you have found your voice. You have stumbled onto it. And the rest of the time was gloriously free to read and write. And by then I was in my mid-30s. I had studied medicine for so long. I had so much to catch up on in terms of reading and writing. So I made great use of the time, and that's how I spent the time at Iowa.
Thank you. I'm glad you asked us to ask you that. as you might suspect, let me say that if you got paid $1 for every question that I have up here, you'd get more than a New Yorker would have paid you. But so I'm going to do my best to try to consolidate these, and please don't be upset with me if your question doesn't get asked literally as you wrote it. They break into two categories. One has to do with your writing and the book, and the other broader issues around medicine and the practice of medicine. I'm going to start with the questions about that relate to writing and to the book. And there were several people who wondered if you had the whole plot line in your head before you wrote this book, or did it evolve as you wrote?
So the story of this book evolved for me. All I had beginning this novel was I had this image of a very beautiful South Indian nun. I had her name, Sister Mary Joseph Praise, and I could see her giving birth to twins in a mission hospital far away from her home in Africa. And that's all I had. And for those of you about to embark on a novel, I hope you have a lot more than that. but I had that, and I had the notion that I wanted to sort of portray medicine to some degree in a resource-poor area, and also the kind of medicine we practice here, and contrast them and also point out how much is similar by the vehicle of a story. But I didn't know very much, and I things sort of evolved. And I think there are two schools of writing. John Irving has written and has said clearly that he knows his whole story. And he doesn't sort of make it up as he goes along. He knows the ending of each chapter. He actually knows the last line of each chapter, he says. And he would say to me, he would say about someone like me, he says, Abraham, if you're making it up as you're going along, you're not a writer, you're an ordinary liar. You're just a... But I do think that there are many writers, I suspect, who don't know the whole story and who sort of carry a voice and a theme forward. I would guess that Michael Ondaatje writes kind of like that. I think that there was a point in this book about halfway through where my agent, my editor in New York, a wonderful woman, you have to have a great editor who you trust, who can tell you, these couple of hundred pages you spend the last 9 months on are just wonderful. They don't belong in this book. But, you need someone like that to guide you. And she called me up and she said, Abraham, I don't think you can afford not to know what's going to happen from here on, because it's going to lead to too many possibilities. There's just too many possibilities for disaster, so we have to know. And so I flew up to New York, and she and I sat in a room and hammered out the rest of the plot, mostly by my free associating and her responding. And I remember flying back feeling enormously relieved. I could concentrate on the language because I knew what was going to happen. Even so, there were huge surprises. So I think that, you know, when I do it again, I will definitely try to plot. But I think you have to acknowledge that there will always be surprises. And in some ways, that is the most delightful aspect of this, is the surprise.
Several people are actually, because many of us do or have to write all the time, wondered about actually the mechanics of how you write. Do you sit down all day and write at a word processor? Do you write a page and reread it? What technique do you follow?
I wish I had a nice pat answer for you. I write when I can. I think it's catch as cash can is the operative word. I tend to compose on the screen, but I always edit on paper. So I think even though I can compose on the screen, to edit, and I think the real art of writing is in the revision, I think it's necessary to edit on paper. I need to print out that big stack of paper. And how else can you say, you know, these 30 pages go here, these 20 go here, and these 40 go in the round file underneath the desk. So the computer gives you this illusion that you can jump around, but really you're only seeing at best one or two pages at a time. So to deal with a novel, you need to deal with pages, and I find handling the paper is important to me. It gives me a sense of pace and volume and so on.
I think an interesting question is how you came by, I'll use the exact wording of the question here, your seemingly thorough knowledge of medicine in Ethiopia as described in your portrayal of Missing Hospital.
Yeah, so, this novel is not autobiographical in the sense that I was not a twin and my parents are not physicians and I did not grow up in a mission hospital. But I was born in Ethiopia, and very much like Marion, I entered medical school in this new medical school that had been just begun by the British Council. And very much like Marion, I left when civil war broke out and the place was, being reduced to anarchy. And so I called on geography that I knew well. And I called on political experiences that I knew well. And so, I think if there's some authenticity to some of that, it's perhaps because I was able to speak to those things fairly accurately. And yet, you know, I still think one does enormous research just to make sure what you remembered was true, was accurate. So does that answer the question, Roy?
Yeah. Good. And often in a book, the title is an afterthought, but it clearly in this book, Cutting for Stone has at least one powerful meaning, and the audience suggests there may be multiple meanings. Could you discuss the title?
Certainly. So, you know, I think titles, I think they work well when they're slightly mysterious. And I think that, it should be that there's a moment in the book or several moments in the book when you sort of have your consciousness sort of expand and echo because you suddenly have a realization of why the title is what it is. Although I must say, I'm not sure that I'm always convinced that that works with every book I read. I admired Wolf Hall greatly, but couldn't understand why that had to be the title. It didn't really mean much to me. So Cutting for Stone is a title I had very early on. I was sure about the title, and it comes from a phrase in the Hippocratic Oath, where we say when we take the oath, I will not cut for stone. And one of the great pleasures of my life as a professor is that I get to watch my students graduate and they stand up and they recite the Hippocratic Oath, mostly, although in some places they've changed it. And they usually invite all the physicians in the audience to stand and take the oath with them. And so, you know, parents and siblings and all the professors, all the faculty stand. And it's a very, very moving moment, something I look forward to. And among all the things we say, we recite this very ancient phrase, I will not cut for stone, you know, which is sort of a strange thing to say. And it stems from medieval times when bladder stones were epidemic. Bladder stones, kidney stones, we don't quite know why. Bad water, no one's sure, but people suffered from stones. The little children would have golf ball-sized stones blocking their bladder exit and would die. And adults were the same. Samuel Johnson, we're told, walked around with a catheter in his top hat and catheterized himself a couple of times a day. So this is why the longevity was so shortened. This is why people didn't live very long. And the suffering was enormous. Can you imagine dying because you can't pee from a big bladder stone? And there were these itinerant itinerant surgeons, for lack of a better word, who had learned this trick of being able to cut for bladder stone. And they'd had it passed down through the, you know, almost like a guild. And they kept very secret about it for the most part. And they would come and cut just above the pubic bone and pull the stone out from the bladder that way. Or sometimes they'd put a finger in the rectum and another one on the belly and press the stone down and hook it down into the perineum and then make an incision 2 inches in front of the anus. This is probably more detail than you want. and they'd pull the stone out that way. And then they would wipe their knife on their cassock and take off to the next city because the patient would probably die the next day. Even though they relieved suffering, sepsis was obviously a great risk. But it was understood that even though your aim was to relieve suffering, if you didn't do this well, you would basically butcher them. And so "I will not cut for stone" was a phrase to keep people away from doing this who didn't know what they were doing. And obviously it has no relevance in our life, but I love the phrase. And I always knew before I had anything else about the book that it was going to be called Cutting for Stone. I had a moment of hesitation when I wrote to John Irving to tell him that that was the title and that my alternate title was The Typhoid State Revisited. And well, he wrote back to me to say that he loved The Typhoid State Revisited,
yeah.
Which gave me great pause. When John Irving likes a certain title, you have to listen. But I held steadfast, and I stayed with that title, and I made The Typhoid State the title of the first chapter, I think. And you know, you won't believe this, but I think this is how books are written. My characters were called Thomas Pickering, Marion Pickering, Shiva Pickering. And I woke up one morning about 4 or 5 years into writing the book, and I thought, you know, if I name them Stone, it'll seem so brilliant. It'll tie in with the title. you know, but I think that is how books get written. And certainly when I changed it, it seemed, you know, just perfect. So there was so many levels of echo. Cutting for Stone meant old-time surgery, but it could also stand for the boys cutting for the father and so on. So it means whatever you choose it to mean. I hope it's slightly mysterious, but also rewarding.
Well, in that context, someone who has clearly read the book very carefully points out that the Hippocratic Oath says, "I will not cut for stone." And at the end of your acknowledgement, at the very end of the book, you say, "I shall not cut for stone."
I think we have a proofreader in the audience.
Yeah, okay.
I will tell you that the Hippocratic Oath is not necessarily, as far as anyone knows, truly written by Hippocrates. Its origins are really quite mysterious and the subject of great debate. And we call it the Hippocratic Oath. Hippocrates might have had nothing to do with it. And given how many iterations it has, I'll stand by, "I shall not cut for stone."
Right. And I'm going to do one more question on the book, then we're going to move to the broader medical area. And that is whether you've been approached for selling the film rights yet.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about it, but I've learned that until they sign on the dotted line, it's just talk. So, you know, I can see that it might be tricky because, you know, how do you portray a twin? Do you have two actors, or do you do what they love to do in the Indian movies where the same person plays the bad cop and the good cop who are, you know, robber and bandit who were separated in early life? So, you know, I think that may be one of the difficulties. So, but there certainly is a lot of talk. I would be very pleased if it happens. But I also recognize it's a completely different art form, so I will not feel greatly invested in that.
Right.
I'm told, this might be of interest to you, that Gabriel Garcia Marquez for many years would not sell the rights to any of his books. The reason being is that, you know, writing and reading are truly a cooperative venture. When you, you know, if you ask me where does the story of Cutting for Stone exist, it doesn't exist in those pages. It exists when you read the book and I provide the words, and somewhere in middle space you make this mental movie, which if I've done right, lingers in your brain, and it's partly your invention. You're picturing the characters the way you want, and you're coloring things that are completely you. And if I explain too much, then you won't like the book. If I explain too little, then I've written Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce, and no one knows what that's about. But you can see why when you go to the movies of a book that you've liked, your immediate reaction is, what, they cast Antonio Banderas in what role?
Yeah.
You know, it will never satisfy any reader because we've all made our own pictures of who these characters are.
You know, one of the great dinner table conversations is to name 10 movies that are better than the book they were based on. And it's a hard list to come up with. Okay, let's shift to medicine. You talked about you're working very early in Boston with the early stages of insights into AIDS, HIV. What is now today, in 2010, the state of medicine around AIDS therapy?
I think the state of medicine around HIV is actually very good as long as you're in a a country that can afford to buy the medicines for its people, which is true here. And, the last 10 years have seen some wonderful ability to bring drugs to Africa and Asia and so on, but there's great concern now that some of that momentum is being lost, some of the grants are not being renewed and so on. So our biggest hope, I think, would lie in a vaccine, and that is still somewhat elusive. There are promises and things look good, and then it sort of seems to retreat. So I think that what has happened, though, collectively, I think there's a complacency in society that says, well, AIDS is not a problem anymore, and clearly that's not so. And the most tragic thing I see is young men who should know better, getting newly infected with HIV, young intravenous drug addicts, young heterosexual people. So clearly we are far from out of the woods, a long, long way to go, especially globally.
You were on NPR speaking, and you talked about the importance of touch in practicing medicine, and several people would like you to expand on that.
I'm not sure I was talking about touch per se. I think the point I was making is, I've written and got into some trouble for saying that in America there's a great danger that the patient in the bed has almost become an icon for the real patient who's in the computer. And I even coined a term for that entity in the computer, the eye patient, like your iPad and your iPhone and your iPod. So the eye patient is getting wonderful treatment all over America. And the patient in the bed is often left wondering, who is my doctor? When are they going to come by? It's a sort of a strange dichotomy. I'm also convinced that we have gotten so good technologically that we've given short shrift to the ability of the body to tell us things that don't need a lot of sophisticated tests. And, it would seem to me that if we have all this wonderful imagery that allows us to look inside the body, we should get better and better at the bedside in making diagnoses and realizing how a certain maneuver is useless and another one is actually pretty good. Instead of which, I joke, but only half joke, that if you're missing a finger and go to most modern hospitals, they won't believe you till they get a CAT scan, MRI, and orthopedic consult. It's almost as though we're distrustful of anything that came from our eyes, our senses. And, my sense is, though, that we're losing much more than the ability to spare patients from unnecessary radiation and so on. I think if you do the bedside exam well, you actually, I think, wind up ordering tests more judiciously and you ask better questions of the tests you order. But I think what's more important is my sense is that the bedside exam is a ritual of great importance. And that may be where that question is coming from. So rituals are, I'm finding from my colleagues in anthropology at Stanford, rituals are all about transformation. We have baptisms to signal a transformation. We have bar mitzvahs and we have weddings to signal our departure from a world of loneliness and solitude and misery to one of eternal bliss. I'm not sure why you're laughing. Wasn't that the intention? So rituals are terribly important. They signal thresholds. And I would submit to you that the ritual of one individual coming to another and telling them things that they would not tell their spouse or rabbi or priest, and then incredibly disrobing and allowing touch, which in any other context would be assault, I would submit to you that that is an exceedingly important ritual. It has all the trappings of a ritual of great importance. And the transformation that comes about is one of a sealing of the physician-patient relationship. It's terribly important. And I think if you shortchange it, if your skills are not adequate to the ritual, if you listen to the patient's chest through the nightgown and your stethoscope on top of the nightgown. And then you know, patients pick up that you are not being attentive, that you are not acting in a manner worthy of this ritual. And I think in the process you lose something. What has been very exciting to me is I've always preached about the importance of the bedside exam and how something more transpires when you do this than just diagnosis. There's an important payoff. What's been very exciting to me is recent research on placebo. We're recognizing that the placebo effect is the placebo is not a sugar pill. We're recognizing that the placebo effect is very, very complex, and it has a lot to do with tone of voice, where the treatment is taking place, the ceremony around it, the manner in which the therapy is presented, and so on. And not only that, we're learning that placebo has profound neurobiological effects. If you give a Parkinson's patient a placebo in the right context, you can measure dopamine levels shoot up in their brain as if they got L-DOPA. If you give someone who is having pain a placebo to block their pain, and you then give them an opiate receptor blocker, their pain comes roaring back. So these are not, you know, placebos are not about tricking patients. They really are buying into profound neurobiological effects. And so to me, this has given me new ammunition to embrace ceremony, to embrace the ritual of the bedside exam. So what I try and teach at Stanford, what we all collectively teach at Stanford, is that this part of the patient-physician encounter cannot be shortchanged. You cannot earn the patient's trust by sitting behind a desk and ordering tests and then saying, well, the test showed this and that. You have to engage in this ritual and do it in a very powerful and significant way.
A question that ties into that asks about some research studies that looked at the difference in outcomes when the physician was judged to be optimistic about the treatment's probabilities as opposed to pessimistic. And and it ties maybe into your point about placebo effect, about how other things are triggered.
I think it very much does. In fact, there's a word called nocebo, where if you give a medication and you do it in a negative way, you can produce a negative effect. Even though what you're giving might be inert, you might actually produce a negative effect. So I completely buy into that. I think that the physician's optimism and their manner of bonding with you, their manner of spending time with you are terribly important. And why not get that 20 to 30% added benefit along with the treatment you're administering, and how short-sighted it would be to miss that. So certainly placebo and nocebo are very much a part of what we're talking about.
There's quite a bit of attention given these days to overuse of antibiotics, whether it's in the farming and agricultural industry or in hand soap. This is totally aside from actually using them therapeutically. What is your general feeling as an infectious disease specialist, particularly about our trend lines towards developing antibiotics and keep up with resistant bacteria?
Yeah, I think we are very worried about that. That's what I think we're most worried about is the pipeline is drying up. There used to be a very vibrant, active pipeline, drug companies exploring many drugs, but I think the process of taking a drug all the way to market is so costly and so so hard that many companies are simply not looking to do that. It's quicker to buy another drug and license it and reissue a generic drug in a new package and start charging more money for it. So it's a very worrisome trend.
Mm-hmm. Let's see here. People are curious about the direction in which healthcare is going, and we all have the experience of trying to find a doctor and trying to get an appointment with a doctor. And there's several questions generally about models of care, and wondering if you could compare what we'll call the historical private practice doctor who will refer you to a not-for-profit academic medical center if you need hospital versus the Kaiser model where there's an integration of the physician, the hospital, and the insurance risk, and whether you see trends in one direction or another in those models of care.
Yeah, I think, I'm certainly not a health economics expert, so don't read too much into what I'm saying. I'm sort of representing the bias of a practitioner and someone who has sort of observed this trend for some time. My sense is that for too long we have reimbursed medical care on a sort of fee-for-service basis, and it should come as no surprise that when you do fee-for-service, if something is very lucrative, then more of it will be done. And I always like to ask my students, I said, you know, you see freestanding surgery centers, freestanding birthing centers, freestanding cardiac centers, freestanding oncology centers. Has anybody seen a freestanding geriatric center with a huge lobby, valet parking, fountain, piano? There's a reason you don't see it. There's simply no money in it. And I think one of the, you know, real sad things about the way reimbursement is shaped right now is that you get, you know, so little for spending time with the patient. It's almost as though you get paid better to do something to a patient than to do something for a patient. And I think that it has been sort of eye-opening for all of us to see how difficult it is to make that kind of payment reform. And one should appreciate why it's difficult. I think we spend something like, I think this is right, $1.3 trillion on healthcare. Do I have that number right? Close. And what someone pointed out to me is that every dollar you spend, who was that right? Sorry?
2.3,
all right. By tomorrow it'll be 3.3. And what someone pointed out is that every dollar you spend on healthcare, we spend on healthcare, is a dollar of income for someone. Physician, hospital, nurse, physical therapist, drug company, and so on. So it should not surprise us that there's great resistance when we try and control costs by any means. But I certainly don't have all the answers. I think payment reform is certainly the next step, and without that, we can't go very far.
Mm-hmm. Well, a follow-up that, though, is to contrast the private practice model, because in the Kaiser model, all those risks of the patient only being a revenue source when they're sick, Kaiser reverses it and tries to keep you well. And
I think it's an excellent model. I think the Kaiser model, and people point to the Mayo model, to the Cleveland Clinic model. There are many models out there, and they certainly work very well in certain closed systems. But now that we are actually going to cover 30 million uninsured Americans and bring them into the fold, what model are we going to apply to them? I don't think any model will work if we don't have payment reform. We simply won't have the savings to cover the 30 million that we're proposing to cover. So, it's not the question of a lack of a model. I think it's really more the lack of a will and very strong, lobbying interests that make it difficult to make anything happen at all.
Well, I'm going to ask you one last question, and I'm going to again make you put on your public policy hat, because it's rare that we get a chance to hear from somebody who actually practices medicine and thinks about how medicine is practiced. Because several people have asked, not so much for your opinion as to whether the health care reform bill was a good, bad, or indifferent solution, but why was it so controversial? What were the forces that were fighting against the enactment of a health care bill?
Well, I think, again, I'm not the expert in this, but I think it boils down to how much we spend on it. I mean, spending $2.3 trillion on health care and then proposing to enact legislation that corrals in some of that spending and proposes savings that will then be applied to, others in the system, that is going to generate tremendous opposition. And I think, every administration that tried it before gave up. Interesting story. I think it was the Truman administration that had thought about bringing in healthcare reform. And there's a very famous painting called The Doctor. And you know this painting? It hangs in the Tate Gallery by Luke Fields. It shows a child in the center of the painting and a physician sort of very intently on one side observing the child, just completely engaged. And the family on the other side, it's a little fisherman's shack, and the family is sort of watching anxiously, and dawn is breaking through the window. It's a very, very moving portrait called The Doctor, perhaps the most famous iconic painting in medicine. And Luke Fields did that painting based on his son dying at the age of 9 on Christmas Eve. And yet when he painted it, he said he was trying to depict the doctor in society. And it was with such great respect and honor that he painted that. Well, when Truman proposed healthcare reform, the AMA took that painting, made it into a poster, plastered it all over doctors' offices with the title across it saying, "Don't let the government take the doctor out of this picture." And so, the forces opposing reform have been marshaled many, many years ago. People say that was actually probably the first successful PR campaign that undid something. Well, now we're very good at undoing things, but at that time it was huge. And so, you know, again, I'm no expert, and I certainly don't think I have the right answer, but I think that when you try and bring about big change that involves lots of money, you will have to have the political will and the forces aligned to make it come about. And it's very, very hard.
Well, for our radio audience, I want to let you know that you have been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our guest this evening is Abraham Verghese, a renowned physician and professor of medicine at Stanford University, but also the best-selling author of the book Cutting for Stone. And we have been listening to Dr. Verghese tonight, and I will put his own words back to him and say thank you for your time.